From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It's the close of a week that began with U.S. President Donald Trump visiting NATO in Brussels, raising questions about the very nature of the Atlantic Alliance. The week closed with Trump visiting the U.K., where he faced street protests and a domestic political situation in serious turmoil. Trump is set to sit down on Monday with Russia's President Vladimir Putin, and with all of these moving parts, we decided it was time for a conversation with international affairs analyst Mark Sloboda. He's a retired U.S. naval officer whose academic credentials include a degree from the London School of Economics, and he's now a senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday. Mark, tell us a little about Trump's latest trip to the continent.
It started off in Brussels, where Trump basically crashed the NATO meeting. I mean, of course, as the president of the U.S., he's the biggest guest there, but he probably did more damage to NATO in a single day than has been done by any military bloc in its entire existence.
That's right.
it was quite amusing for us who don't agree with the continued existence of NATO, particularly us military vets who don't agree with the continued existence of NATO. Then Trump jetted across the channel to the United Kingdom, where he is now being protested against by huge crowds in London, and he had a meeting with Theresa May, the unelected Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who is bumbling badly Brexit deal with the EU. And just before Trump arrived, this caused her Brexit secretary and her foreign secretary, Boris Johnson, known affectionately in the United Kingdom as Bojo the Clown. Bojo also quit, saying that Theresa May was making a hash of Brexit and it was ending up to be Brexit in form, in name only, without any substance, and with actually just as beholden to EU laws and regulations, which was, of course, one of the things that those who voted Brexit wanted out of. So while Trump is meeting with this beleaguered Theresa May, who is holding on politically by a lifeline, having just lost two secretaries and so on, he's meeting with Theresa May, something that pretty much both political sides in the United Kingdom have no love for Donald Trump. I mean, I'm sure there's a nationalist minority in the United Kingdom, but the vast majority of the people in the United Kingdom, when even the Evening Standard is taking out full pages against his visit and so on, which is a conservative center-right newspaper, then you know that this is pretty much across the board.
This is pretty much the same phenomenon we saw in the electoral landscape in the United States during the election, by the way. Not just the Democrats were vehemently against Trump, but so were almost all of the Republican leadership.
Yeah. Except in this case, I think it's a large percentage of the British public as well, not just the political elite. So as Trump is meeting with Theresa May, and they're walking in together, to a dinner, her fumbling at him, trying to get him to hold her hand, which is was quite a comical sight just to watch that. If you want to try to watch Theresa May holding Trump's hand, I'm sure you can find a vid of it online. Trump had given an interview to The Sun, which is essentially a British right tabloid. Yeah, certainly not a paper of record. Anyway, he had given a interview to the Sun beforehand, and as he's meeting with Theresa May, this article was published, this interview with him. And during the interview, he said, "Speaking of Mr. Johnson, who resigned this week as foreign secretary in protest over Mrs. May's Brexit strategy, and who has long been seen as a likely challenge her for a job," Mr. Trump said, "Well, I'm not going to pit one against the other. I'm just saying I think he," meaning Bojo, right, "would be a great prime minister."
Right. No.
"I think he's got what it takes." Yep. "And I think he's got the right attitude to be a great prime minister." He said this while he's meeting with the actual British prime minister.
Exactly.
It's very possible that she could face an internal party challenge from Boris Johnson. And Trump steps right into this. And, you know, the title I saw from the New York Times was, "With May's government teetering, Trump gives it a shove." Right. And I think that's pretty accurate.
Yep.
I think we got to give the New York Times credit where it's when it is due. And I think that's a pretty accurate title. This is what Trump did. He walked right into this mess that's in the UK, this political mess going on right now. And he just gives it a good shove.
You know, what's interesting, too, if you look at the recent history. Okay, first of all, Brexit, the referendum to exit the EU, on behalf of the UK, won. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, ways to parse the results of that, and also, you know, has that changed? You know, people calling for another one. But fact is that Brexit won, and that May opposed Brexit while it was pending.
And then
said, "Well, you know, this is what the people wanted, so I will enforce it." Then has mismanaged it, according to just about everybody, certainly according to the supporters of Brexit. And now you're seeing, Johnson and May's main person handling Brexit resigning over the past few days over the, you know, essentially the fact that Brexit hasn't happened, hasn't moved forward, and, you know, isn't shaping up in the way that people think, you know, that was chosen by the voters. So they're all kind of bailing on May and her handling of it at the same time that Trump shows up. And so it's kind of an interesting political configuration. You know, the whole, like, landscape is kind of in flux there. And so when he's pushing, he's not just going to push her so she slips and falls, but maybe so the whole apparatus tips over some.
Yeah, and we've got to remember that, you know, the vote went to Brexit, and that was actually a surprise to almost everyone.
Right.
Most people were predicting a 5% swing the other way. Instead, right, it was a 5% swing towards Brexit.
Right.
And, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that half the British population supports it. It's the half that voted.
That's
which,
right,
you know, in a democratic section, that's what counts.
Right.
So while just over half of, you know, the British population supported Brexit, the other half virulently opposed it. Virulently.
Right.
And this is particular the liberal urban cosmopolitan population, which means the population of London. And that's where Trump, of course, is sitting down in the middle of this. This is Remain, you know, territory. This is Remain, right, territory that he's in London. And he has already had various Twitter wars with the Muslim mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, that have over the issue of Islam and immigration and so on. So he's sitting down also into the middle of this. And so during the protests today, quite a wonderful showcase of the British liberal public's political maturity. This puerile stunt. They've got a giant orange Trump baby blimp flying,
right,
over the protests today.
Mm-mm.
And I expect the protests to be quite large, which is really quite amusing because other than rhetoric, there is so very little that Trump has done that Obama wasn't already doing.
Right. You know, well, again, you mentioned how divided the vote was.
It was.
You know, nationally, it looks like the Democrats and Republicans nationally in the United States. You had 51.89% voted leave, 48.11% voted to remain. In other words, Brexit, no Brexit. You have London and the other, you know, essentially where the upper middle class and the managerial class live, voting to remain. They're sort of a cosmopolitan kind of, you know, worldview. Not the internationalist, but the globalist view of things.
Yes.
And those who are skeptical of that and either looking back or looking beyond to their regaining sovereignty were opposed. Now, he's in the middle of London, which was the bastion of the Remain vote on the one hand. So the vote, you know, the protesters are definitely going to turn out there. And like you mentioned, they're polarized like Democrats and Republicans are here. If say, Chuck Schumer were to give a speech in some Midwest city, you would have all the Republicans that were sitting there turning out to protest him, like you do when Trump goes into some place like New York or whatever.
Yes.
But what's interesting, some of the contradictions are, when the Brexit vote was held in 2016, Boris Johnson was the mayor of London.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the proponents of Brexit.
He was the biggest proponents of Brexit.
That's right. And Trump also, internationally, was probably the only one who not only accepted the fact that the Brexit vote, you know, was legitimate, but also said, "And hey, by the way, it's a good thing."
Yeah, he did. He did quite famously say that, and
yep.
he has talked about crafting some type of special trade deal with the United Kingdom to compensate for the lack of relationship with the EU,
right.
Which the Brexiteers jumped at, but that hasn't really amounted to much except for Trump giving tariffs that
right.
have affected the United Kingdom as much as they have other countries.
Right.
In his. You know, trade war on the world, essentially, as it's going right now. I think, well, of course, we don't know the result of that. Trump may be savvy enough to understand that actually his voice of support for Boris Johnson with the British public would actually go the other way.
Right.
Would actually tank Boris Johnson.
Right.
And Boris Johnson has had some rather public unkind things to say about Trump
right.
before.
That's right.
I don't know how self-aware Trump is on his the opinion of him with the British public.
Mm.
I have an unfortunate tendency, I think, sometimes to underestimate the man. But how much he's aware of other countries' political situation, I'm not sure.
Well, the one last thing I would say on this point about Trump is that, you know, from one last thing I have to say is when Brexit won, the first words that we heard out of the political elite here under the uh-oh column was, Trump could win. If Brexit won, Trump could win. Right.
Yeah. So that of course proved to be the case, and that just shows that, you know, the liberal political elite, you know, which includes the media and pundits and everything, you know, have repeatedly underestimated nativist, anti-globalist, populist. You know, we use that word populist, meaning the people who have been hurt by neoliberal economic globalization.
Right.
Populist is somewhat is this dismissive word. You know, what is the opposite of populist? Elitist?
Yeah. right. I know.
I certainly don't believe that anything Trump is doing is actually going to make the economic situation of you know, the people that have been adversely affected by neoliberal capitalist globalization. Now, he's not going to bring their jobs back to the Rust Belt. And I think there was some self-awareness of that. I heard, actually heard interviews in the U.S. and in the Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan that they knew or at some level there were some interviews that said, we know that Trump isn't actually going to be able to do much for us, but he spoke to us. He's the only one who
right.
even acknowledged that globalization has hurt us, because
right.
part of the whole propaganda supporting globalization, oh, it's better for everyone, and you can just retrain and get a better job in the city, you know.
Right. That's right.
All right, as a 50-year-old, a laborer, you know, used to working in heavy industry, which is of course ridiculous. The globalization has had winners. It has had lots of them, and it has had lots of losers too.
Millions.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and you know, the liberals who, you know, and neoliberals on the Republican side, who, you know, who supported this all the way, they have always neglected those people. And Trump tapped into that, you know, however unfairly, however he may not in any way be a champion who can help them in any way, you know, and Brexit is a parallel vote that happened in the United Kingdom, because, again, it was largely a vote on many ways over globalization and how Britain was tied into the economy and the globalist economy through it, and the loss of sovereignty that Britain faced to the European Union, which is the penultimate neoliberal institution. And speaking of the EU, if we just go back a day to the NATO summit in Brussels, where Trump blew in, already having voiced his opinion many times that he thinks that NATO is an antiquated organization that serves no purpose in today's, you know, post Cold War world, you know, which Trump, you know, like the proverbial clock, he's right twice a day, and of course he again right on this, but he has been demanding that NATO members live up to the long-standing a guideline that NATO members should spend 2% of their GDPs on their militaries, on what they call defense spending. And there's only 8 out of 29 members of the NATO that actually do that. And the U.S., of course, is one of them, spending far over that amount. The remainders are the United Kingdom, Poland, a couple of Baltic countries, and most of those have and Greece and Turkey, which are spending money on arms against each other, of course.
Right, which is insane.
And Germany and Greece, which is mandated by its bailout deals with Germany and the rest of the EU to buy arms from them. We'll give you some money to bail it out, but you have to spend this percentage of it on weapons that you actually don't really need.
Right.
To help our own domestic arms industries, which is really a sin if I've ever heard one. So Trump blew in, demanded, not only is he demanding quite loudly that not only do they work towards meeting that 2% goal, but they meet it immediately.
Right.
And then when there was, you know, some polite befuddled pushback from this from Jen Stoltenberg, he said during the interview that Germany starts attacking Germany, and he says that Germany is a captive of Russia,
right?
Because they are because they continue to get energy from Russia, and they have signed a deal which is, you know, still not 100% finalized for this Nord Stream 2, this pipeline to go under the Baltics that will bring Russian gas directly to Germany, another Nord Stream 2 pipeline, of course bypassing the troublesome transit countries of the Ukraine in particular, also Poland. Germany is always looking to increase its use of gas as it moves away from coal, in its you know, to try to be a little bit more environmentally friendly in its energy mixture. It's using increasing amounts of Russian gas. And Trump said that makes them a captive country. And he doesn't understand why the United States should continue to pay more of its military to defend Germany against Russia when Germany is cutting deals, energy deals, and building pipelines with Russia.
Well, the specific thing that he said had an interesting internal logic to it. And he was saying basically, because you have Russia, which has the natural gas easily available through this pipeline once it's constructed, very logical in terms of delivery. There's no added, fossil fuel weight, like shipping natural gas by boat from the United States. It's not fracked. Right. It's not fracked. It's not destroying, the water supplies on the ground. Environmentally, it makes much more sense to do it. Economically, it makes much more sense to do it because the overhead is so much lower because of the location. Physically, it makes much more sense because of the proximity. And so Trump is saying, however, you're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to Russia instead of paying it to us. And now you want us to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to defend you from Russia. Don't make no sense. That's what Trump was saying. And it's an interesting statement.
Yeah, it is. Well, in a way, he's actually right, of course.
Right, exactly.
Right, right. Because it points out the absolute contradiction. That,
exactly.
Of course, Russia is no military threat, not a conventional military threat to Germany. Russia's
our economic competitor. Germany. That's what he's saying. Is it not a military threat? They're our economic competitor, and that's what NATO's for.
And he's absolutely right about that.
Yep.
Russia is not going to invade the Baltics. Right. They haven't done anything against the Baltics. They're not going to, run over Poland. My God, you would have to pay Russia to take Poland.
Yeah,
they're
right.
quite happy to let that political problem fester in
on
the
its
EU,
own,
where
yeah.
Poland has lots of disagreements, of course, with the EU government in Brussels.
Right.
But Trump's angle on all of this, of course, is not that. It's that, and when you stop buying Russian gas, you then buy our more expensive
fracked gas.
Liquefied natural gas, which has to be processed at a port at a high cost, shipped much more unreliably than a pipeline across the ocean,
tankers.
And then deprocessed at the other end.
Right.
And it makes it much more – it would make it very – economically uncompetitive for Germany's export-orientated government to start using U.S. liquefied natural gas.
Right.
And he said, on top of it, and you buy more of our weapons, Germany is one of the biggest countries that is not meeting by quite a substantial amount its 2% goal.
Right.
And he said, and you can meet your 2% goal and buy those weapons from us on top of it.
Right.
So
right.
he's essentially his angle is that of a thug, of a protection racket.
Right. Right. That's true. But said, and then another contradiction this whole thing sits on top of, however, and see, the somebody around Trump must know these facts that we're discussing. You cannot just willy-nilly in Germany in particular, but also more particularly in places like Greece, Italy, Spain, France, Spain, Portugal, the places that are really looking at austerity since at least 2008. You can't turn around and tell the public there, look, I know we took away your pensions. I know we've been closing schools and hospitals. I know you're starving and in foreclosure, but we're going to have to pull out some more of the safety net so that we can pay more money to NATO to protect us from Russia. Doing that is going to put people in the streets, and some of those countries, it may actually end up toppling them. That's the political situation on the ground in Europe.
Now, Russia threat, Russia threat, Russia threat. Meanwhile, it's NATO that is massing troops on Russia's borders, right? It's not Russian troops in Mexico, right?
That's right.
It's U.S. troops on the border with Russia, essentially in violation of previous treaties, permanently stationed. They try to say they're not breaking that by having the troops rotate out and new troops rotate in, which of course Russia finds just offensive, right?
Right.
And the EU countries alone of NATO spend four times what Russia does on their military every year.
Right.
The United States alone spends more than 11 times what Russia does on its military every year. Even the U.S. ally Saudi Arabia is now spending alone more money
than
Russia is on its military every year.
Yeah.
But Russia threat, Russia threat, Russia threat.
Also, what's interesting about the Russia threat, you had in 1989... Russia occupying militarily, like the U.S. occupies Europe now, all the way up to Russia's borders, Russia occupying up the center of Germany, more or less, and Russian troops stationed throughout Eastern Europe, you know, in terms of battle plan against if there's a war with Western Europe and the United States. Now, that whole frontier has moved to Russia's borders. So in terms of a Russian threat, quote unquote, it is the smallest that it's been since actually 1917 or whenever the 20s when the Baltics came into the USSR.
Yeah. And the reality of this is that Russia is no threat to right. NATO, to the EU, it's not going to invade any European country. This is all about Ukraine. This is all about, this is all a consequence, and all this noise is what it's about, is that, you know, the countries of the US and the EU, they openly backed a putsch with what was a Banderite fascist right. vanguard, overthrow a democratically elected, if flawed, government in Ukraine that was elected by the people of East and South Ukraine, overthrew that, and then begin a war to subjugate the east of the country, to this new seizure of power, which they didn't accept because they had elected Yanukovych previously specifically to prevent these people, not because they loved Yanukovych or because Yanukovych was corrupt free. Yanukovych was corrupt, every previous government, and Ukraine was corrupt. The new West-backed regime is just as, if not more, corrupt. That's Ukraine. They didn't elect right. him because he wasn't corrupt. They elected him because he was supposed to represent the interests of the ethnic Russian and Slovak Ukrainian, East Ukraine, which is right. heavy industry, Russian speaking, and so on. Right. It's identity issues, East-West right. identity issues in Ukraine. The guy they elected was overthrown with open right. Western support and orchestration, with the biggest display of meddling that you can possibly imagine, with U.S. and EU politicians flying into the yeah. center of Kiev, Independence Square, cheering on crowds that were calling for revolution, and then starting up and funding propaganda outlets supposedly instrumental to the Maidan. I'm talking about Hromadskaya in right. particular here. That was openly funded by the U.S. and Dutch State Departments, whose constant tagline on the station 24 hours a day was Revolutsia, which is revolution, right? Right. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, that was an openly U.S.-backed putsch. U.S. and EU pact. There's no question about that.
You have John and McCain, then, and you have Nuland and all these people sitting at the head of, on a stage in front of tens of thousands of people that are running out and burning things down and killing people.
Throwing hundreds, thousands of Molotov cocktails a day, seizing government Amazing. Buildings. And there were some pro-EU liberals among them, and there was a lot of far-right ultra-nationalists who were right there with them. When John McCain and Victoria Nuland are doing photo ops with Oleg Chanyabok,
right.
the leader of Svoboda.
Goose-stepping his way in, yeah.
Yeah, which was described even in Western mainstream press as fascist, and it was actually condemned in EU council EU council reports. They're saying that no one who supports democracy should support this party,
right.
Because they're xenophobic and anti-Semitic and far right and everything. Until they did, because it was geopolitically possible for them to flip the Ukraine.
Right.
But Russia resists against this, right? It gives the people of East Ukraine in Donbass what they need to defend themselves in terms of money and arms, just like the West was giving to and has propped up the government, the new regime in Kiev.
Right.
And it helps the Crimea, which was almost entirely pro-Russian, the chance to hold a referendum to rejoin Russia, because that's where Russia's Black Sea Fleet was still based.
Right. Sure.
Through agreements reached with the Ukraine that had just been renewed. Russia wasn't going to lose this permanent military port, not to mention the pro-Russian population there, because of this West-backed putsch.
I'd like to do when we talk next week is take a look at the upcoming visit, which is the big event, the summit between Presidents Trump and Putin. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure, as always, Mark.
Okay, thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.